It is the morning after in Africa. The old flag is down. The new flag flies at the masthead. The ceremonies are over and the distinguished guests have gone. The deeds are signed. There are new men in Government House. The old ones have gone. This is independence. This is nationhood. This is the triumph achieved. This is the end of the revolution. Of one revolution, perhaps. But there is more than one wind of change blowing in Africa. There is another revolution underway, more complex, no less profound than the fulfillment of political consciousness. And it is this other revolution, these other issues, which confronts Africans, their leaders, and the world beyond on the morning after. It confronts us, too, in this program.
Africa, the other revolution. A program produced by United Nations Radio to be heard in many languages in many parts of the world. Produced towards the end of greater understanding of the needs and drives which characterize the age we live in. Based on words said and things done in Africa, in other parts of the world, and at United Nations headquarters in New York. Africa, the other revolution.
Before this year ends, there will be 17 United Nations member countries from the continent of Africa. Their populations will total over 150 million. There are not many generalizations about nations and peoples in such dimensions which are both valid and meaningful. But this is true of Africa. She is poor. And just as Africans have proved themselves determined to make certain changes in the way they have been governed in recent centuries, so it is very apparent that Africans are determined to do something about their poverty. This is the voice of the Secretary General of the United Nations.
We now rejoice in witnessing the acute desire, even the impatience, of African leaders for rapid modernization. A new synthesis of tradition and aspiration is emerging in this continent, with distinctive features, which is bound to be a significant addition to the common fund of human experience.
Poverty in nations is akin to poverty in individuals. She is poor, we say about Africa. And by that we mean that the great mass of Africans, compared to inhabitants of other continents, eat less well, dress more cheaply, live in poorer houses, have less to spend on schools and doctors, and other social and material benefits. They're able to save less from their earnings, and so they can invest less in the economic progress of their own continent. What is the cure for poverty? Reduced to very simple terms, it can be said that skills and capital applied to natural resources, that these are the essential elements in the prescription. Each of them concerns the United Nations directly. We're on the street corner of an African city. This man, walking casually past the shop windows while he strums his guitar, is named Edward Nandwa. What are the words of his song? I was once a herdsman, a good hunter of wild animals, but now I live in town. Once I was a stupid fellow, But now I speak good English, and I own a suit of clothes. But now I do not work. Edward Nandwa, a man who knows what he wants, who knows the kind of life he wants to lead, but a man essentially ill-equipped, unskilled, to make his way in this kind of life. Unskilled.
Skill,
says Arthur Lewis, a distinguished economist, until recently in the service of the United Nations.
Skill is the means of accomplishing the greatest amount with the least possible effort. Lack of skill is an intolerable burden on a country. Take, for example, the problem of raising food. In Europe or America, a single family working on the land will feed itself and about 8 other families. In Africa, a single family working on the land will feed itself and perhaps half a family more. The difference is largely due to lack of skill. No nation can have a high standard of living when the great majority of its people is kept at work raising food. The possession of a high standard of living entails the release of the majority from the drudgery of subsistence, so that they can be available to provide the goods and services which a developed modern state requires.
For a man to be without the skill to sustain him in his vocation is a personal tragedy. For a nation to be without the skills it needs for development is cause for national suffering. We use this word skill in its widest sense, embracing education, know-how, ability, training. For all of these attributes, there is evident a thirst in Africa. Many of them are present to some degree, as a few cameo interviews will show. This is Salisbury, Rhodesia, a printing shop. The name of the linotype operator is Nelson Chaweo.
I started as a junior compositor, but when the linotype machines came to African newspapers, I was one of the first people to be taken on as a linotype operator. My first wage was £2 a month, but now I'm getting £35 a month. Mm-hmm. I've got a family of two, of which live in Highfield, where I bought a house under the 99-year lease. My wife doesn't work. She's always at home keeping up with the little one. I think my first son is going to be a doctor. My second son probably is going to be a lawyer. I think by the time he goes to take up a doctorate course, I will have saved enough money.
In Dar es Salaam, we spoke with an African businessman, Amos Rupia, whose skill and shrewdness has placed him at the head of a considerable business organization active in transport and real estate.
When I went into the business first, I started with 250 shillings. I had my friend who gave me a loan of his truck. I started with carrying goods, and then I turned to buses, and then I started to improve building some native type of the houses.
All over the continent, this phenomenon of African entrepreneurship, of expanding business activity, of industrialization, is creating a demand for new skills. Transport companies need trained mechanics. Business offices need stenographers. Factories need machine tool operators. The men and women are there, lining up for the jobs by the hundred. But the skills are often absent.
The real position is of an acute shortage of labor here.
Dr. Joseph Price, head of Ghana University College's Department of Government, said that to us when we spoke to him at Legon.
Despite loose talk about unemployment in this country, and despite the fact that there are large numbers of people who look for jobs which they are not qualified to take, the real position is of an acute shortage of labor here. Attempts at industrialization in this country so far, things like tobacco factories, you know, making local cigarettes, breweries, mineral water factories. The big building contractors are, after all, industrialists in their own way. Have all run into tremendous difficulties about labor. To get a man and train him is just not on. They want a stable labor force. And they won't be able to get that until you have been able to release indigenous people from the land.
At all levels of employment, From the manual laborer to the qualified physician, African labor costs are estimated to be the most expensive in the world. Manual labor is expensive because it's fundamentally inefficient. You get less done for the money. Skilled labor is expensive because the costs of training are enormous compared to costs in advanced countries. This was spelled out for us by Mr. E.A. Vasey, Kenya's Minister of Finance.
The handicap to our economic development is that with the lag that we had in the past of educational services and the period of time that elapses between your putting a boy into school and bringing him out as a trained man ready to play his part in an economic world, we have had to import most of our skills and knowledge from overseas at prices set by expanded and developed Western countries, which are far too high to be borne by a country whose standard of living for its people is less than £35 or, say, $100 a year. Therefore, we do need help from the outside world, but we really need it much more on the educational, technical and general side, so that our people can be equipped to run their own country at their own standards of living, instead of having to deal with imported knowledge and skill, which has to be paid for at a price set by economies far more wealthy, advanced and developed than ours.
The Prime Minister of Ghana is on record as declaring that it costs more to graduate a student from Ghana's university than it does anywhere else in the world. This, we learnt, was not only due to the relatively high cost, by local standards, of the physical plant and buildings of the university.
What you see now, as you look round at Lagon, has actually cost, as far as completed buildings are concerned, about £6 million. And by the time all the existing contracts are wound up, we'll have spent £8.5 million.
But because each instructor has to be brought out from Europe or America, maintained at high expense, and given extended leave because of climatic conditions. And frequently, these dearly bought teachers have to work with students well below the required standards. At Makerere University College in Uganda, which serves all of East Africa, Dr. John Ehrlich told us,
"We've been taking boys and girls into Makerere at a sort of pre-university level and wasting our buildings and staff and so on this, what we call it, higher school certificate instruction. It costs, I think, a tenth of the amount to keep a person at school than it does to keep them here."
But despite the costs and the disappointments, more money, not less, will in future go to support the universities of tropical Africa. More emphasis, not less, will be placed on the need for them to continue their work. Luvenium in the Congo, Makerere in Uganda, Lagon in Ghana, Ibadan in Nigeria, University College, Khartoum. These are beacons of hope for millions of African youngsters, but only handfuls of these millions will achieve their ambitions.
And education, naturally, is a key point in the whole situation.
Mr. Hammarskjöld was speaking at a news conference held shortly after he returned from an extended journey through Africa.
Education is not only broad education at the bottom. It is not school teaching and book learning. It is the methods by which you bring people not only to national awareness, but to the point where they form, as free individuals, their judgment on political issues. Education is also the method through which you get the doctors and the engineers, the administrators, and, to some extent, the political leaders. In a way, the problem is there on all the levels. Primary, secondary, college, specialist training, and so on. And the nuclei are there in several parts of Africa, but insufficient. And for that reason, one of the major efforts must be to get this part of the infrastructure developed as quickly and as wisely as possible.
The United Nations is already engaged in assistance toward building an educational infrastructure in Africa. in helping to meet the cry for learning, for skill which is manifest in all parts of the continent. Directly and through its family of specialized agencies, the World Organization is helping African nations build their schools, staff their training centers, equip their labs. The assistance is modest in extent because the means available internationally are modest. But this help can do much sometimes through its strategic character. Example, at the village level. In a remote rural mountain settlement in Ethiopia, a small UNESCO team is training a cadre of village officers in the techniques of self-help, of fundamental education, as it's called. The team's leader is Roger Garreau, a Frenchman.
I chose this place because I wanted some place far from a big town. I wanted some terrain in an area where the people would need some help. The requirement was a community which needed service from me. Health, agricultural improvement, education, literacy campaign, water supplies.
The place chosen was Majeti. To this village, the government is sending annual classes of 30 trainees.
We took them from 8 different provinces. The intention is that what our trainees learn here, they will apply in other villages. They are sent to try to develop the community. My aim is to send them to become the technical advisor to the chief of the village. This is a pilot project in Ethiopia.
In other parts of the continent, the work of transplanting skills takes other forms. Accra, Ghana.
Miss Ella Griffin and Mr. Rampano of UNESCO are assisting the government on the production of reading material in local languages. And Mr. Norman Spare of UNESCO collaborates with the Community Development and Social Welfare Division on the use of visual aid in the education of the rural communities. An FAO specialist on agricultural extension assists the Ministry of Food and Agriculture in promotion of agricultural education and extension methods. Similarly, Ms. Steckley of FAO, as a specialist in home economics, assists in training of personnel.
An aviation training school run by the International Civil Aviation Organization in Addis Ababa. A technical trade school established with ILO help in Khartoum. Schools of public administration in Cairo and Monrovia, run by the United Nations. In all, during 1959, 619 United Nations experts served in Africa. 436 Africans were sent abroad for study and training. In 1960, about 20% of United Nations technical assistance funds will be spent in Africa for this work of sharing skills. We've just looked at some of the ways in which skills are grown. But where does capital come from? How does it flow to Africa? These are questions for an economist.
From the money markets of the world for good and promising business opportunities in Africa. From the coffers of metropolitan powers for the economic advance of the territories for which they are responsible. These processes began early in the 19th century, although individual merchants have been putting money into African schemes for a much longer period. What kind of projects did this development capital go into? Well, there were the directly saleable African products, like gold and diamonds and ivory. And there were the African products which served industries in Europe and America. Cotton and sisal, wool, copper, and manganese, and many others. These have been the traditional sources of Africa's development capital.
And these are still the principal means whereby African projects obtain the money they need. But there are two other sources of capital just coming into operation.
One new source, which hardly existed before the Second World War, was the earnings and savings of Africans themselves. There has been a great increase in Africa's earning powers, largely because of the boom in African raw materials. And some of this money has been invested locally by Africans. The savings bank, the building and loan society, the credit cooperative are all increasing in effectiveness on the African scene.
In Tanganyika, we learned something about this process from a young African businessman, David Mukwaya.
The Post Office Savings Bank has had quite a number of accounts for many years, but not so many Africans had opened, accounts involving large sums of money. When building societies came into being, the greater impetus was given to the idea of thrift by Africans. Quite a lot of the business of the Post Office Savings Bank got lost in favor of this particular building society. And their numbers are increasing. But of course, it's just a question of the putover, getting the Africans to know that such facilities do exist.
Private money market capital, nation-to-nation loans, nation-to-colony investments, local savings. To these must now be added another new source of capital for Africa, not yet large, but important in a number of ways. International money, the World Bank.
Since last April, the bank has made 9 loans in Africa, totaling over $260 million.
The president of the World Bank, one of the UN's family of international organizations, is Mr. Eugene Black. He spoke recently to the Economic and Social Council.
2 of these involve the mining and transportation of manganese deposits in the Gabon Republic and of iron ore in Mauritania. A third finance the construction of a pipeline to bring Sahara oil 400 miles across the desert to the Mediterranean. 2 of our African loans were for transport improvements. Another interesting feature was that the loans to the Congo included one for African agriculture. This was also the objective of another loan of $5,600,000, which will assist African agriculture in southern Rhodesia.
In all, the World Bank has over 750 million invested in Africa and is increasing in importance as a source of capital for African governments. But the continental thirst for advance, the aspirations of African countries and their leaders, far outstrips the availability of investment money today. African projects must compete, often on difficult terms, with projects in other countries. And so Africa must offer either better rates of interest to investors or else projects of greater security. Which brings us to the third corner of the triangle: skill, capital, resources. What has Africa got? What can she offer as a lure to the investor?
A great deal. Africa is a vitally important source of many minerals and metals. Gold, diamonds, cobalt, iron ore, copper, asbestos, manganese. Many other mineral prospects lie beneath her plains and hills. Africa has the greatest untapped reserve of water power left in the world, a full 2/5 of the world's total potential. Africa produces most of the world's cocoa, half the sisal, 20% of all the coffee. Also large shares of the world's wool, rubber, sugar, cotton, and palm oil. The discovery of petroleum recently in Nigeria, Libya, and the Algerian Sahara suggests that one of the world's great oil fields may lie under Africa's big desert.
How to weld resources to skill to capital? How to enable nations or groups of nations to know what they have in terms of resources, both natural and human? It was to meet this need that the United Nations Special Fund was created.
There are only a few of these countries inherently poor.
This is the voice of Mr. Paul Huffman, the fund's managing director.
Most of these countries are poor only because adequate use has not been made of their physical resources and their human resources. The problem is utilization.
How can the special fund help a country to know what it has, to use what it has?
There is in Ghana a geographical area known as the Volta Plain. If drained, land would be available for the growing of sugar cane, of cereals. You would have the foundation for the establishment of refineries, a new industry. So we put several hundred thousand dollars into a survey of the Volta Plain, and the hope that out of that will come not only 50,000 acres of new tillable acreage, but also the foundation of a new business.
These are some of the ways in which the World Organization helps Africa during this period of the morning after, with modest but strategic assistance in the movement of skills to Africa, with the provision of some loan capital, albeit a fraction of the amount Africa needs, even a fraction of the amount Africa gets from other sources, with the means to help Africa discover what she has in the way of human and physical resources capable of development. The utility and effectiveness of such assistance can be greatly enhanced by the manner and the timing of it. That was what Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld recently had to say to the United Nations Economic and Social Council.
We face a situation where very great expectations have arisen, where the people are looking for an opening up of the future from their government.
The UN Secretary General was speaking of some of the problems confronting African leaders in the period immediately following independence.
However, the government itself, facing those demands, has to take into account a few very natural factors which complicates their task. There will be necessarily, unavoidably, a certain outflow of administrators that, quite irrespective of any political stance, people who previously invested more or less automatically in the country may hold back, not out of distrust, but because they want to see a little bit of trend or the development. Resources which were available under the budgetary arrangement of the metropolitan power are no longer available in any sense automatically. To sum it up, at the same time as a newly independent country is facing natural demands and expectations from the people, they are, on the other hand, facing specific difficulties arising from a certain reduction of administrative facilities and a likely reduction of means available.
And Mr. Hammarskjöld adds,
I feel this is the point where the United Nations does carry a special responsibility and has, in a certain sense, strategic importance. They should be entitled to expect from the United Nations modest assistance, but such an assistance as does facilitate their immediate task and give them a little bit of the elbow room they need during the first period.
Yes, the new flag flies at the masthead. The new hands guide the wheel. Independence Day has come and gone in this, our African land. The one revolution is over. The other is just beginning.
The program just concluded has been Africa, the Other Revolution, a United Nations documentary about the problems facing newly independent countries. This program introduced the words and voices of Dag Hammarskjöld, Arthur Lewis, Nelson Chaweyo, Amos Rupia, Joseph Price, A.E. Vasey, John Ehrlich, Roger Garraud, Kouros Satrap, David Mukwaya, Eugene Black, and Paul Hoffman. The program was written by George Movshin and produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio.